Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. And before we jump into this, I want to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Marlene and Stuart Greenebaum Cancer Center, an NCI-designated cancer center providing research, treatment, and education to further the prevention of and cure of cancer. Online at www.umgcc.org, or the number for information is 1-800-888-8823. Or you can go to steinershow.org and click on their banner, and all the information is there. I'm encouraging you all to join us here at 410-319-8888. In the studio with me right now is Fred Bielfeld. Frederick Bielfeld, of course, is the Baltimore City Police Commissioner. He has served on that force since 1981 and has been commissioned now for 5 years.
Just started our fifth year.
Fifth year. And folks, many of you called to praise and protest this commissioner, so now's your time to talk with him. 410-319-8888. Many of you in the past weeks have questioned things about the police in your neighborhood. Please join us here with your thoughts, 410-319-8888, and you can be part of this conversation. So, Fred, welcome. Good to have you in the studio.
Well, thanks for having us, Mark. Thank you. I appreciate it.
And this in this political season, your department is talked about a great deal by candidates. And one of the things, let me just ask this broad question first before we talk about all the things from Officer Red to all the other issues that you've been facing here, that we've been facing here in the city. We had a discussion today with some former policemen and people from the Hopkins Police Leadership Program. And the part of the conversation had to do with the culture of police, the internal workings of police. And one of the questions they were wrestling with is what can control that or change it? When police, like a lot of other professions, physicians and others, have this circle-the-wagon mentality, we protect our own. We don't tell what goes on between us. In other words, here's how it came up. This came up in regards to the towing scandal. And if 50 officers knew about it, then 250 knew about it, knew what was going on. But nobody would say a word because you don't do that. And if 500 police officers knew about it, probably everybody knew there was an inkling of it going around the department that something was amiss. So, but that's all inside the culture. So, and one of the things that, they had this article in the New York Times the other day about changing the culture of the police in L.A. and changing the nature of the police force in L.A. I don't know if you saw that article or not. But it all had to do with the culture.
So here's a couple of things, right? So one of the things that I've tried to avoid is just these – like blanket indictments or overgeneralizations. I think the basic premise is right, that we should be constantly assessing and challenging ourselves in terms of what kind of relationships we have in the community, what kind of quality of service we provide or don't provide, what kind of level of professionalism we have. And those are the kinds of things, if you start boiling down to specifics, then I think, Mark, you can start leading to some specific reforms. But let me share with you some insight about that case and to tell you
about how
inaccurate people's perceptions are. I'll share with you a little inside baseball here. On the eve of that arrest, and this is all history now, and it's absolutely, people know to be absolutely so, we didn't just wake up that morning and decide and go to make these arrests. It was very, very well orchestrated, incredibly well orchestrated, with incredible planning ahead of time, right? Would you concede that?
It had
right?
to be.
We lured them to the police academy under a ruse, right? And the premise was, in luring these officers to the police academy, was that there was a problem with their weapons, right? And they had to come up there and to get their weapons serviced. And I got phone calls from some of the primary investigators on a couple days in advance of that predetermined date and time to make those arrests and said, we've been compromised. People know it's out there. Cops are talking inside the department about this arrest.
The pending arrest.
Yeah, that people know we've been compromised. And do you know what happened that day? I was absolute, based on what we had heard, and if that was true, and if there, and if what you just led off was saying there's this culture and cops know everything and cops know everything about everything, I was certain if that was true, why would they have shown up? And do you know what happened? All but two showed up. And those two, one was out of town. He was doing something in town, away. And the other one was literally out of the country. All the other ones showed up. They all showed up. Do you know why they showed up? They had no idea. They had no idea that was taking place. And so for people to say there's this culture and cops know everything and what one cop does, the other cops know, and they're all talking about it, isn't it conceivable? Isn't it conceivable that people, criminals, can be involved in criminal conduct and be trying to keep that secret from everyone? That's possible. Now, in that larger context about that case, one of the things that I'm challenging myself on in terms of who knew what, I think there are some very, very legitimate concerns. Like, there had to have been radio communications. Who was paying attention? What leadership? What were sergeants and lieutenants and those sorts of folks? What were they doing? And what did they know? If they were really paying attention to their people, why wouldn't they have observed that? Those are the kinds of things. But as a blanket indictment on all of the cops, that somehow the large body of the BPD is indictable because of the criminal conduct of a few, it's just, again, it's an overgeneralization that I just think is dangerous for people to adopt as a way of judging what we do.
And let me kind of say it in a different way then. I didn't see the question as an indictment of everybody in the police department. I mean, I think that there's a mountain's worth of difference between somebody taking a kickback from, not that it's not all illegal, a kickback from a towing company, and somebody dealing drugs while they're on the force. Those are two very different kinds of criminal activities, very different. And people see it that way. I mean, I can see that somebody in an internal affairs department is not going to start leaking internal affairs investigations so that the entire department knows what's going on. I would think that much more unlikely than if I'm working on the street, I see something going on, I know what's going on, but I choose not to say anything because it ain't that big a deal and this is his problem, I'm not going to get in it. And people have to know. What you just said, sergeants, dispatchers had to see some kind of flow of certain towing agencies getting these calls all the time and the same officers doing it. I mean, that's what I'm talking about. I'm not saying that every cop is a crook just because they knew or had an inkling this might be going on.
Yeah. I think that part surely is legitimate. That part about, you know, and we should be analyzing and challenging, like, who knew what and what did they do about it or didn't do about it, and we should be holding them accountable. What I can tell you and what we continue to demonstrate is when I find out about these things and when it gets to my level or other people find out about it, we've taken action. You just could, one of the compelling things here is, you know, Mark, is you asked me, you know, it's been a busy summer. It surely has. And, you know, we've gone from horrible tragedies to, you know, these incredible criminal cases that, you know, some of this is a two-edged sword, right? And I don't know. I think somehow in the general discourse of these things, I think that part is very often missed, right? Because a lot of people sweep their floor in their kitchen. A lot of people do. And most people get in there and they'll scrub their floor, right? Some people use the new Swiffer. You know, you can spray that thing and it's got the disposable pad. Very few people, right? I do the same thing, right? Very few people do it the way our parents did, our mothers did, right? Very few get down on their hands and knees and actually scrub the tile and get the grout clean again. And almost no one is willing to pull the refrigerator out and clean behind there and get all the junk that's fallen back there. Very few people are willing to do that. We've been pulling the refrigerator out and looking behind there and trying to uncover all that stuff. And when you do, you find stuff you don't want to find, but you got to deal with it. You could push the refrigerator back and say, nothing back there. Or you could get down and deal with the gross stuff and get your hands dirty and make the place clean.
Commissioner Frederick Bielefeld III is with us. He's the Baltimore City Police Commissioner. It's time for you to join the conversation. 410-319-8888. Or write us here at steinershow.org, and we'll take your calls and emails on the air. And we have an email and some calls, 410-319-8888. Let's go first to Jay in Middle River. You're on the air.
Good afternoon.
Hi, Jay. Welcome.
The story you just told about impropriety on the force, and I would even first commend you for doing that. But second, how do you get to a community level of enforcement or even prevention better off and make it plain to your constituents and your citizenry to say, look, when we have breakdowns, this portion of it is attributable to character issues, or this portion of it is attributable to resourcing issues. How do you either allay fears or get people more knowledgeable about exactly what it is that, you know, may inhibit you guys from having, you know, certain breakdowns? I'm not saying all the time, but sometimes. How do you make them more knowledgeable about that?
Yeah, wow, great question. I think that, you know, it's a multifaceted thing. Some of the things I think stand on the face of where they are. I mean, for example, one of the discussions that came out of the towing case, there was a discussion in city council about the confusion between cops at the scene of accidents. And it was pointed out that very often police officers in one district give different advice to motorists that are in another district. For example, they'll say, you can't call your own tow truck, that all accidents have to be towed to City Yard using a medallion tow. Well, that's simply not so. That is certainly a training issue that we have to work on to communicate what people can and can't do. And so that's difficult to get that kind of word out in mass. It's an internal thing that we have to fix when we see it. Cases where people are doing egregious criminal conduct, you know, we had years ago, several years ago, there was a Baltimore City police lieutenant, and you remember this case, I know you do, had a severe gambling habit. He was robbing banks.
Mm-hmm.
He was robbing banks. And we had another officer robbed a bank several years ago, robbed a bank on his way to work and was wearing uniform pants. When they described the pants, we knew the FBI agents in my was long before my time, but the cops recognized those are police pants. And started narrowing the field down. And so those kinds of things aren't training issues. They're not, you know, there's no way to communicate, you know, what we're going to find those guys and put them in handcuffs. That's what we do about those guys. I think there is a lot to be said about how we communicate these things out too. That's been a big challenge, right? I'm sitting through, and even now, you know, people are telling me what I shouldn't say and be cautious of saying. These jobs, Mark, you have to be incredibly careful and circumspect that you don't jeopardize criminal cases. You don't jeopardize civil proceedings. You don't jeopardize ongoing cases. And so people want to know, and they have every right to know, and they should know. But I can't tell them everything, and I certainly can't get on the radio and just spout off about every single thing that and every single detail that I know as much as they want to know it. Let me give you another example of this. Do you remember, I lived through this and you lived through this, it was just down the street from here, horrible tragedy a few years ago when Councilman Ken Harris was killed.
Yeah.
Horrible tragedy. Do you remember, and this is where we're such poor historians and few people really want to be honest. Few people. Do you remember what the central angst against the police department was in that case? Do you remember it? Tell me what it was.
I don't remember it, to tell you the truth.
Oh, my goodness. The central angst in anybody that worked in homicide and anybody who went through there was we were protecting.
Oh, right.
Tell them.
Protecting the woman who was with Ken
Why?
Harris.
Why? Tell me the conspiracy, Mark.
Because he was, she was, he was married, and she had something to do with the police.
And what was the, what happened, what was the truth of that? She didn't have anything to do with the police.
Right.
We were protecting her identity because it's our obligation to protect the identity of witnesses. That's our obligation.
Well, then, talking about obligations, a lot of people calling in. And Jay, thanks for that call. Oscar, Sean, Bruce are the next few callers up. And this email we have that came into steinershow@gmail.com from Barbara Stratton. And we're going to read her email. But when you talk about these things, one of the things that some papers wrote in an editorial around the case of Major Nathan Warfield being relieved from his office as Commander of Internal Affairs after his was seen on his Facebook page with Officer Daniel Redd, who had been busted for dealing heroin by the FBI, and also when there was Sam Brown, another guy who had been indicted on a number of serious charges but then not convicted of those charges, but had been associated with people in the drug industry. And they were saying, look, we understand that Commissioner Bielefeld can't say everything, but you got to say something. You got to, they are, and many people's attitude in the community is, I mean, how could that, things like that, had not say anything about what could have happened here? He must have known about the investigation. Maybe he didn't. But one would assume, since he was in Internal Affairs, has to work at the FBI, he must have known something. And if he was so close with these guys, why was he on there for so long? And if he was working with him under and helping to get this guy, then why was he fired? So those kind of things people want.
Well, he wasn't fired.
Not fired.
He hasn't been relieved. He's
relieved.
He was moved from a command. And I think that all the questions you ask, really, you can answer them. But, like, why would he be there now? And so, again, I have to be careful, right? I have to be very, very careful what I say. And, again, I think if people really understand – the issues around personnel issues and what our limitations are in terms of what we can't say publicly. But here's two essential facts that people need to keep in mind. We took that case, we initiated that case and took that case to the FBI. We did, inside the BPD. And we investigated it with them using some of our resources. And so and it was a fairly lengthy investigation. And I could tell you that, you know, I mean, I wasn't in the dark about what was going on there. I had pretty good I have a great relationship with the local SAC of the FBI, Rick McFeely. And so I obviously knew what was going on there. And then at the end of the thing, we did what we did, and we moved them out. Now, people want to know every intimate detail. They want to know every single thing, but they gotta—they at least have to acknowledge that we're committed to doing something, and we're taking action. One man is in federal custody, facing substantial. Criminal charges, and we moved the head of our IID unit out of there. Now, I'd love to be able to say more, and maybe I'm sure there will be a point in time where more can be said. But right now, that's the extent of what I can say.
I guess part of it is also, and then I will open the phones here. Oscar, coming up next, we have a bunch of other issues to deal with as well. But I think that. A lot of people have a real difficulty with a lack of transparency in government, period.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's something you can't comment on and won't comment on and in relation to comment on, like the Baltimore Development Corporation and their deals with developers and why people are saying, why can't the public be in meetings to see what's going on?
Sure.
Same thing with the police department.
Yeah.
People want to know. I mean, people think there's too much of a lack of transparency inside the department and every other level of government in the city.
Agreed. I totally agree with that, and I understand. I understand that people, and God bless people, all shapes and sizes and opinions and ideas. And so some people are going to come down on the side of, I get it, we trust them, and we trust that they're committed to doing what they say. And remember, you know, I've been on your show many, many times, Mark. Over the last 4 years, I mean, I remember other places we've been on, yes. Right, in other studios. And I said then, if you played those shows back 4 years ago, Mark, I said, I tell my guys everywhere I go, I tell everyone, don't judge me on what I say. Judge me on what we're doing. Judge me on what we're doing. People were asking me 4 years ago, what are you going to do about police corruption? People calling into your show. What are you going to do about holding cops accountable? We've been arresting cops. That's what we've been doing. We've been working our tails off internally with good detectives doing great detective work, trying to build good, strong prosecutions against cops that do criminal things. That's what we've been doing. And so some people are going to come down on the side of the guy's backing up what he said. He's going out and he's holding people accountable. And some people are going to come down on the side of, I don't believe a word that fat, bald guy has to say. And I'll never trust them. And so it's going to range in that whole gamut. So I get it. I understand that. And people are entitled. Absolutely. God bless their opinions. So
let's open the phones, as I promise. 410-319-8888. Oscar, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, Oscar. You're on the air.
Hello?
You're on the air, Oscar.
Okay. Good evening to you and to the commissioner.
Good evening.
Yes, sir. Good evening.
My problem, commissioner, is this. I think you don't talk out enough. When you just gave the example about the Kenneth Harris case.
Yes, sir.
The same people, the exact same people who said they made this conspiracy up are also saying now that down to select rounds that the police came down there with the purpose, the intent to assassinate Officer Torber. That's what they're saying. They put this out constantly, and you know, if you tell a lie long enough, some people might begin to believe it. I retired from the Baltimore City Police Department after 25 years. My former side partner is an FBI agent. Her husband works in your homicide detective and homicide unit now. I take great offense. If police do something wrong, I will be the first one to say something about it. I have said things about it. Any kind of thing that they do that I think is wrong, shootings, anything like that, I've spoken out about it. But to come up with this kind of foolishness, to say that this man was assassinated by four police officers in uniform in front of 33 other police officers and a crowd of people is beyond foolishness. This is dangerous kind of talk. And I think you should come out and say something about it, because as long as you keep quiet and don't tell the stories, the crazies are going to make up their own stories. And I think it's absolutely disgraceful. And they're saying this, and they're using this for political purposes. Now, I don't know you personally. I don't know. You probably weren't even there when I was there. Were you there when Palmer was the commissioner?
I was there for 2 months when I came 2 months before he left.
Okay, Palmer, Battaglia, Bishop Robinson, none of them would tolerate this foolishness. Mm-hmm. They would make these people pull them out and call them out by name and say, what is your proof of this? A lot of people believe in this thing about Kenneth Harris, that he was with a policeman's wife, and they assassinated him to keep him quiet. They also said the police cover up the suicide of Robert Clay. They said that was a murder.
Yeah.
They said the police had something to do with the killing of Jonathan Luna.
You know, one of the things, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Oscar. First of all, God bless your service. I'd want to say this, you know, and look, I have a front row seat to all of it. I mean, you know, and people aren't talking about homicide detectives. They're talking about the police commissioner. And again, that's absolutely their right to do. And they should challenge me. Some of this stuff will never be satisfied. It will never be satisfied. You mentioned Robert Clay. I was chief of detectives then. And the Robert Clay case had been reviewed internally. And his death occurred while I was a major in narcotics. And I remember hearing a little bit about it. Commissioner Norris, it was Commissioner Norris at the time. I remember hearing a little bit about it, but it wasn't in my area, so, right? Later, after I got promoted to chief of detectives, the issue was still out there in the community. And I remember being hauled into a city council hearing. And we had provided, we had been in meetings, the department, I say we, I mean the department, had been in meetings with all sorts of folks about that case, the family and a lot of other people over the years. It had gone on for years, the controversy. And so I got, the police department got hauled into a city council hearing, Mark, and you know what the demand was? Now, please don't forget your history here. Oscar
well.
Can tell you what the history was. Do you remember what the demand was? What was the demand? The demand was that the Baltimore City Police Department could not be trusted, and their investigation was so flawed that the demand was that the FBI were the only ones that could be trusted to investigate this case, and please let the FBI. Now, the FBI had said up to that point, there's no reason for us to be involved in this case, and they had declined to be involved. And we were at that hearing. We made a phone call and said, okay, enough. If this will put it to rest, once and for all, we'll go to the FBI. And the department at that time made a phone call. Would you please look into this case? The department asked for it. And the FBI took it on. And after several months, you know what they came back and said? Oscar, do you remember what they said? Is Oscar still on the line?
Maybe. Forget it.
Mark, do you remember what they said? The FBI said, we have nothing, our investigation has nothing to change the findings of the Baltimore City Police Department. And you know what people still say today? They don't believe, now the FBI is wrong. Now the FBI is part of the conspiracy. And so back to Oscar's point, what happened on that parking lot outside that club is a horrible, horrible tragedy. That's what happened on that lot. That night was just an absolute tragedy for this whole city. What I say, what more could I say, the mayor say, could anyone else say about that case?
When you talk about that was a horrible case, and I know the owner of the club very well. He's an old friend of mine, and it was tough, very hard. It still weighs on him, and the councilman was a friend of mine as well. So, but Oscar, thanks for your call. But when things he first brought up here, and I think that, and then we'll go to break after this question, and we come back from this break. It's Sean, Bruce, and Leo, and an email we're going to get to before I say another word. Nothing had happened on some shows recently, but people whose job it was to train police officers write manuals across the country, a retired major from the state to state police, even though Greg Bernstein declined that there was no indictments and said that said it was, we're talking about the shooting that took place outside the club where William Torbett and Sean Gamble were killed. Most of those police in these institutes have said, there is no reason that 42 shots should be fired in a situation or any situation. That if you are, as one officer said, if you are confronted that way, it's time to back up and take cover. You don't empty your gun in a crowd full of people who have no weapons. And that, so you're shaking your head no. Why are you shaking your head no, Fred?
Because for people to get on here, supposed experts to say that, they're just, it's just foolishness. It's absolutely foolishness. It's absolutely and frankly totally irresponsible on their part. What happened on that lot was a horrible tragedy. But for people who weren't there, who weren't in that situation, to come in and purport themselves as experts about what was on the mind of those four unfortunate people, that this horrible trip, the six, nine people who suffer in these families, to promote themselves through some kind of purported expertise about the difference between one shot and 10 shots or how the shots were fired is just flat out wrong. There isn't that much analysis that goes on about how we sweep the streets, let alone confronting an incredibly dangerous or dealing with a dangerous situation with people firing guns and people being killed. And people can come in and get into that, purport to have that level of expertise about whether the officer fired too many or too few. It's just not this case, not just this case. There are many, many cases you could go and go through that kind of analysis. The bottom line is these two men are dead and three women were injured. And again, I'm going to say over and over again, people are going to – I wish they would just – it's a horrible, horrible mess and a horrible tragedy, one that those families are never going to get over and our family will be suffering through for a long time. Now, do we want to know how we can do it better? Do we want to know how we can improve moving forward? Do we want to know how we can – better train our officers so we don't get to that point? The answer is yes, 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 and yes. And we're dedicated to doing that. We took an unprecedented step. The mayor asked for, and we worked hard to join and help facilitate going outside and getting a review panel, a review board together to try to achieve just that. But this Monday morning quarterbacking by people who don't know the facts, very often have never been in those situations, and I wasn't there, and none of those supposed experts were there, and to place themselves and say that is just, it's just wrong.
We'll leave that there for the moment. 410-319-8888. We're going to take a very short break, come right back with our police commissioner, and in this order, we'll go right to Sean, then to Bruce, then to Leo, pardon me, then to Barbara's email. Go right back. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. I'm here with Commissioner Fred Bielfeld, Police Commissioner here in Baltimore City for the last 5 years on the force since 1981. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. And as I promised, right to the phones. And Sean, you're on the air.
Good evening.
Good evening, Sean.
Good evening, sir.
Commissioner, first of all, I think it's great, and the host of the show as well, I think it's great that you guys do this, and just for your transparency and being willing to kind of be out there for people to, I don't want to say take shots at.
Well, it's everybody's entitled to their opinion, so
right.
Let's get right to it.
All right, let's do it then.
Yes, sir.
The relationship between citizens and their police force, it's kind of general and vague, but I had an instance. As you know, teenagers go through different phases, and preteens go through different phases, and sometimes they're not always I don't want to say obedient or respectful to their parents' wishes. And I had a situation where a friend of mine was looking for his daughter and his son. They were out late. They didn't have permission to be out there. And they live in a rough neighborhood in the city. And a friend of mine was, you know, basically, and I was there. A police officer had rode by. It was a high-ranking police officer in the Western District. And he asked the guy, he said, hey, you know, basically he tried to get the officer's attention, and he was letting him know, if you see a, you know, two kids who are out, it was about 9:30 at night in the summertime on a Friday night, it was about a year ago. If you see two kids that are, you know, out in the street, you know, could you, you know, let me know, because we were going to be making rounds, and the police officer, I guess, was making his rounds.
Yes, sir.
And when I say high ranking, I'm talking about it was a major.
Yes, okay. Sir.
Mm-hmm. And I know what rank looks like. I'm not ignorant to the fact.
Right.
The response to the friend of mine and myself was so rude. First of all, he acted like we were bothering him. He had his music turned up. He was riding through in his pristine vehicle, and he acted like we were bothering him. Now, I know I'm not naive enough to believe that Officer Friendly is still alive. I'm not, you know, or that's a concept that we still, you know, promote in the inner city.
Right.
However, part of your job is you're a civil officer. Civil, last time I checked, means peace.
Yes, sir.
I know you deal with a lot of people who are miscreants or deviant. However, it's still the regular citizen who has not committed a crime, who is interested in seeing where the children are, and who just would like for you to, if you can, keep your eyes open, because you were stressing at the time. That response, and I've seen this on more than one occasion from the police department in the city, and I'm not saying everyone, but there's this sense that we're bothering them. There's this sense that I don't see them in high-risk neighborhoods. I have friends who live on Park Heights in the Northwestern District, and I don't see people up and down the beat, and I see open-air drug dealing right in those areas.
Yeah,
and I'm not saying they're not there. Maybe when I'm not there, they're just not canvassing the block. But whatever happened to the days where people actually knew the people that were in the community, and instead of there's some prevention that can go into dealing with the youth.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. And again, I can't. I'm not going to get on the show and act like, you know, we come with, you know, a whole bag of new tricks, because where we've been successful is in going back to some basic things. And one of the basic things we've been hammering away at, and I can't take full credit for it, Commissioner Hamm really tried to get the department started, and that is getting cops out of cars. And I've been working and working and working in my tail off to try to convince cops to get out of cars and engage with the people they serve. It's not a public relations gimmick or fad. Again, this is something I talked to you about
when you first
5 years ago, right? Yeah. 4 years ago. And you asked me then, what was the strategy? How are we going to reconnect? How are we going to win back trust? And I think we win it block by block, person by person, house to house, by getting cops out of cars and establishing relationships with the people we serve. It's one thing for people to say, I don't like Fred Bielfeld, or I like Fred Bielfeld, and forming their judgments on that basis. And I think they'd be wrong on either stretch. I'd rather them judge us on the relationship they have with the three officers that are assigned to their neighborhoods on the day work, 4 to 12 at midnight, that are making their neighborhood safer. I'd rather they judge us on the quality of their service. And while I certainly think you're right and the behavior he talked about is wrong, we have, and I recognize and am committed, and I pray that people in the future that lead this department will stay on this track, that our police officers have got to get out of cars, they have to establish relationships, and the only way I know to do that is to put them out on foot and get them to talk and walk and serve the people of this city.
Why over 5 years has it been so hard to do that?
Well, some are doing it. I mean, doing more and more and more. But it's something that didn't happen overnight, Mark. You know, I started, Pete and I, Detective Sullivan and I, we started our careers. There wasn't even 911 in the city. You know, and I'm not trying to be like old school nostalgia here. But the fact of the matter is we had time to walk. We had dedicated foot posts. We had dedicated foot squads all over the city. My grandfather policed here. I don't know that man ever drove a police car. And surely, I mean, he started in the 40s and 50s, and you know, there weren't a lot of cars. But this whole – and I don't want to hijack this conversation into some way, because I know – I've heard enough of the show to know that a lot of people are concerned, so I don't want to get into too long a discussion. But the bottom line is, over the last two decades – policing, not just in Baltimore, but across this country, took a left-hand turn. And the left-hand turn was farther away from the people they serve and dealing with their concerns and dealing with what we thought we should be doing. And I think that was a mistake. And I think it's going to take a long time of people like the caller you just said, of demanding that the people, that police get reconnected with them and hear their concerns.
Well, I'm going to get to the phones here. Let's go to Leo on Bolton Hill, then I'll read the email. But Leo, just jump on the phone here. But when Leo finished, I guess I still understand, Fred, is explain why there can't just be an edict from the commissioner saying, you're going to get out of your car.
Because they handle 1.3 million 911 calls for service. And there aren't 4,000 police officers patrolling this city. And so it just gets down to, do we have the resources to be able to get cops to patrol neighborhoods on foot and handle calls on foot? The compromise is to try to put them on bikes, but when you start doing the math on 1.3 million calls for service, one of the big things that's confronting me in a Northeast district, I keep hearing all this noise about, and people are right to be concerned about more police, more police, more police in the Northeast district. You know what we found when we did the analysis of it? That their calls for service on the day work and their calls for service on the midnight are very much in line with the other nine districts, the other eight districts. But the balloon, the bulging effect of the disproportionate number of calls for service in that district on the 4 to 12 shift creates such a massive backlog going into the midnight shift. And so the bottom line is you got to figure out what to do about 4 to 12 in the Northeast District. You got to pump additional manpower into that district, something we're doing right now to try to solve some problems in dealing with a call for service problem. But the bottom line is it's not just something that you can say and instantly order, because the 1.3 million calls for service don't stop coming in.
Leo in Bolton Hill, you're on the air.
Mark?
Leo, you're on the air.
Yeah, can you hear me?
You're on the air.
Okay. Commissioner.
Yes, sir.
I'm concerned about two areas, one of which deals with Sean Gamble and William Torbett. The 911 tapes have not been released, the audio. I'm not certain why that is the case, but those of us who are activists in the community and people of long standing are concerned and feel it's outrageous that you have not shared the 911 tapes as was promised originally. And my last question deals with the December 10th of 2010 judgment rendered against your department by Sergeant Hobson and 12 other black police officers. You were found guilty of practicing racial discrimination in the hiring practices of the police department by the federal government. And
that's not true.
Federal monitor.
That's not true. You're just saying things that aren't true.
You were found guilty.
The fact is, sir, we settled the case. And three previous police commissioners dealt with that suit. Three previous police commissioners dealt with that suit. And all of them fought, delayed that suit. And I, with my team, looked at that case, and we settled the suit. That case never went to trial. And so you are factually wrong.
Let me go with another call here. 410-319-8888. Well,
let me add one more thing that's just not true either in the last call. We released the 911 tapes, and we released that to the Sun by virtue of the MPIA request that was filed on behalf of the files. And so we released the 911 tapes. They've been provided to the Sun paper. And so, again, this is where people call up and say whatever they want to say. It's just not true.
What about people saying there were videotapes that were not released?
We released the video. We released the videotape. Now, people can be mad because the TV stations didn't air the entire length of the video we provided. But we released the videotapes.
410-319-8888 is the number here. There's an email. Let me read this email from Barbara in Baltimore. Our family was the victim of misconduct by a Northeast District Police during an incident that took place at our home April of 2010. In July of that year, I filed a complaint with the Northeast Police, but nothing ever became of it. When I tried to follow up with the district several times, I was told that the complaint department was understaffed and backed up, and that if they didn't get to my complaint within a year, that it would be dropped and none of the officers reprimanded. When the year mark approaching, I called your office and was told to continue to follow up with Northeast District, which I did again. My call was not returned. What good is it to have a complaint process in place if the complaints aren't actually addressed? Please advise me how to proceed. Thank you.
Well, if her complaint wasn't addressed the way it should have been, then we're wrong. I'd have to look into it further. But the notion that someone's going to say we're understaffed and so we're not investigating is just – it's ridiculous. Because we do investigate. We investigate hundreds of complaints, and we try to do them as timely as we can. So that being said, if you have a copy of the email,
we'll give it to you.
Very much would want to get in touch with that lady.
We'll give that email.
And the other thing is Anthony's helping me out here. I want to make sure that people understand what they can, how they can facilitate these complaints. And the line at our IID is staffed during normal business hours, but also is a recorded line. So there's on-call people staffing that, and they should be able to call 410-396-2300 to express their concerns and file their complaints.
We will give you that email before we walk out
Please,
the door
thank
here
you.
In 10 minutes. 410-319-8888. LaVon, you're on the air.
Hello to the commissioner.
Good evening.
Thank you also for coming on the program. Two questions that I have. Being that a lot of people, especially the African-American community in Baltimore City, have very little confidence in, you know, seem like the police department doing right by African-Americans, why did they not initially have an investigation done not by the police department? I mean, you have very little confidence in the police investigating itself. That's number one. Number two is, why don't they use surveillance cameras inside police vehicles?
Yeah.
Especially if you want to talk about accountability and full disclosure, that would help alleviate some of the issues that, you know, the department seems to be having with the community that it states serves.
Right.
That's my question. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. I think the mayor made the right call, and again, we worked hard to assemble a panel of national experts to really review our procedures and our handling of this case. And again, one of the things that I have to be incredibly careful is not to, you know, really undermine the diligence that they've been dedicated to over these past several months, these many months in putting together their report, which we're all anxious to see. And so we took, under the mayor's leadership, an unprecedented step to ask for this panel of experts to come in and give us a critical eye on what we did and what we could do better. So I think that part is important, and I think it's important for people to keep that in focus. The last part about the cameras in police cars gets back to my original point. First of all, it's impractical in the nature of what we do. We don't police from police cars. Even to the extent that cops are in cars, we're not on the side of 95 or 83. The cops get calls and they get out and they go in apartment buildings and row houses and in courtyards, and so they're all over the street and they're away from their police cars. And I've said, I'm not being facetious, if I had enough cops, I've had enough police officers in this town, I'd sell every police car I had. I'd put them out on bikes and horses and on their on shoe leather. And so to invest in technologies in the cars, I think, is wrongheaded. You know, one of the things I'm going to say, Mark, and I know I'm going on with this answer, is one of the things that police officers – you talked about culture. Your very first comment at the beginning of this was addressing police culture. Well, here's a part of police culture. They've looked over the past two decades. They've steadily built up that police car as their mobile office. I never looked at the police car when I was out there as an office. I viewed it as a way to get me from point A to point B and go do my work. And cops, police officers now look at that thing as their office space. They have computers in there and they have air conditioning blowing on them. God bless them. I want them to be comfortable. They can recharge their cell phones and you know, do all sorts of stuff, communicate with Venus from those cars. I don't want them in cars. I want them away from cars. And so to keep investing in cars and investing in cars, I just think is a wrongheaded approach for this police department.
Let me try to get another caller or two in here if we can. Marsha in Charles Village, you're on the air.
I just want to thank both of you. I love the channel because you actually do report the news. And
thank you
to the commissioner. I live in Charles Village, and I live in Lower Charles Village, actually Old Goucher, and there is a continual problem with the prostitution. We have transvestite prostitution. We now have what appears to be a whole new type of prostitution, mostly Hispanic women. And the police know about this. We've done neighborhood walks. You know, it's really disgusting that it doesn't go away. It just moves from one block to the next. The police are very unresponsive to it. And two nights ago, a friend of mine's window was smashed in his car. His $50 worth of quarters were stolen. There are condoms in the alleys. I don't know why this has to persist, especially when we've made the police aware of it. Oh. And, you know, people don't have a lot of respect for the police because they're not polite to us. I was involved in a car accident, and they were the policeman was very rude to me, and there was no reason. I was sitting in an ambulance when he was rude to me. So, you know, I don't know what to say. It's just if something's got to change because
– My apologies, Marsha. We only have like 2 minutes left in this hour.
That's all I have to say.
No, that's good. I just want the commissioner to have a chance to respond to me about 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Your complaints, the complaints that I've heard about Charles Village are not new. I'm aware, and I know the district commands have been aware of the transvestite, transgender problem in the neighborhood. But I am also aware because the fact that it has reached my office, I am aware of what we've been doing on the back end of that. And I know that arrests have been made. And I know that Major Bizzurro before and now Major Tap Harper are working with the community in Charles Village. I know that we're working with our partners on the COP walks. We've been up there ourselves and on these COP walks. I don't disagree that more needs to be done. The what we have done, clearly much more needs to be done in terms of the policing side of this. But the other aspect is that by ourselves, we've not been able to solve this. And the community working, just simply working with the police, haven't been able to solve this problem. And whether it's the homeless people or drug addicts or vandals that are breaking into cars, again, this is a problem that we certainly are trying to confront. But we need to do more, and there needs to be a more comprehensive effort for
sure. Email we can't get into, but I think that it's a perfect way to end this, and I think we should maybe talk about another day. David Miller, who is part of the Urban Leadership Institute, wrote in to say, greater community education with parents and youth around navigating police encounters, figuring out ways to deconstruct a us versus their mentality needs to be addressed. Things will not change unless the critical issue is addressed. This is a national problem. We've been doing some work on this in Philadelphia. But that's another day.
We
should do that. Yeah. Commissioner Bielefeld, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for hosting, Mark. And I appreciate the calls and I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
And we'll get you covered that email and we'll be right back. And when we come back from this brief break, we will be talking to Bill Berry and Bill Delaney about the strike at Verizon. 410-319-8888. Stay with us. We'll be right back.